Welcome to PM Lessons Learned, a podcast for project managers, helping project managers by sharing lessons learned. Increase your PM knowledge, build business relationships, increase your effectiveness, increase your marketability, gain professional support. Join our group and take part in our conference calls. Details at pmlessonslearned.com.
Well, hello, and welcome to the PM Lessons Learned monthly PMP study group conference call and podcast. This is podcast number 82. We're recording the session on the 1st of October, 2009, and we are now totally focused on version 4 of the PMBOK guide. My name is Dana Spafford. I'm your host for the PM Lessons Learned monthly PMP study group conference calls. I've been a PMP since version 2 of the PMBOK, way back when. I'm also a Microsoft Certified Systems Engineer and have only two tests to go to complete my ITIL version 3 expert certification. I have over 25 years of project management experience in the IT industry. I actually work for Hewlett-Packard as a complex problem manager, which means that I take a very complex situation that is affecting an HP customer's enterprise production environment, and I manage a project with a virtual technical team that can quickly resolve whatever the issue happens to be. So remember, you don't have to have the term project manager in your job title to actually be a project manager. Our presenter for this session is me. How about that? The topic tonight is project procurement management as the, according to the PMBOK version 4. What we'll be talking about, as we know, the PMBOK examination is now based on version 4 with a guide to the project management book of knowledge. And this month's PMP call focuses on the procurement section of that, the procurement management area, as it's laid out in version 4. There are a whole bunch of different changes in this area from version 3. And what I'll be doing is providing some insight and some practical examples of things that you'll need to know to build up that critical knowledge mass and pass the PMP exam on the first test. Now, if you haven't downloaded a PDF copy of today's presentation for this podcast, you should do so. We distribute the file through the Yahoo through Yahoo groups, so you'd have to go to Yahoo.com to do that. We have a group called PM Lessons Learned. If you need the steps to sign up for Yahoo groups, then go to PMLessonsLearned.com, and in the left-hand column, you'll see a pointer to files and presentations. If you are already a member of Yahoo Groups, once you're logged into Yahoo Groups, go to My Groups and then the PM Lessons Learned page, and you'll find the files link in the left-hand column. And from there, you select materials for the monthly PM exam study group. And from there, it'll be down about halfway as we're recording this on October 1st. Who knows where it'll be a month from now, but it's about halfway down the list. It's at the top level of that folder. The file name is PMLL Project Procurement Management October 1st, 2009, or 1 October 2009 is a PDF file there. And the actual title of the file is PMLL Project Management Procurement 1 October 2009. Okay, you'll also see a whole bunch of files from the last couple of months at that top level. And there's also an updated PMBOK version 4 brain dump in there as well for those who need a brain dump and practice your brain dump before you actually take the test. And if you look into the past monthly PM exam study group calls folder, you'll find over a year's worth of files in there. But you got to be really careful there because of those files, because a lot of them are based on version 3 of the PMBOK. This conference call series has been around for 3 years, so they've spent a very long time in version 3 of the PMBOK. There's a lot of stuff in there that's version 3 related. Anything you pick up from that's dated June of 2009 beyond is guaranteed by me to be a version 4 related file, because I've been doing this for almost a year now, and I've switched over to version 4 in June of 2009. But if you want to go over some of those old files, if you are in a bit of a rush to get going, there's only about a 30% difference from version 3 to version 4, and it's pretty much all in the processes and their ITTOs. So some of the other material in there, if you sort of take the processes and ITTOs with the version 4 flair, you can still get some things out of those older files. And finally, if you're on a shorter time scale and are willing to make a commitment to actively participate and take turns in presenting study group material, we also have a weekly virtual PMP study group, and that might be for you. If you'd like to try that or get some more information on that, send an email off to pmpstudy@pmlessonslearned.com. And I'll say that one more time slower, pmpstudy@pmlessonslearned.com. And hopefully no one who is driving, listening to the podcast, tried to write that down. We don't want anybody wrapped around a telephone pole while they're trying to write anything down here. Okay, so we are pmlessonslearned.com. We are project managers helping project managers to make a difference. I'll thank you in advance for everyone who's participating live on this call. Remember, you'll need a *6 your phone to unmute in order to make any comments or ask any questions, and then do another *6 to remute your phone so we don't listen to a lot of background noise. So thank all the live participants, and I'll also thank the people listening to the podcast. And with that, why don't we get started? And what I'm going to do is start on slide 1 of the PDF file. And we have a whole lot of other administrivia here. We have the schedule of our conference calls. The monthly PMP study group is what we're in right now. This is the first Thursday of October in 2009. And then on the second Thursday of each month, we have a PM job shop. And that's where if you're in transition or you are looking for a job or you know some jobs that in the project management area that might be available, join there. Same number, same time, just the second Thursday of the month and participate there. And then finally, on the third Thursday of each month, we have the PM Lessons Learned conference call. And that's where we talk about generic or general type of project management topics. We have a whole suite of featured speakers, many of which are noted authors. And you can find their books on online and in various project management stores, bookstores, and such. So we have that call every Thursday of the month. If you have some time, same place, same number for that call as well. And you can also listen to any of the previous calls either on the phone by going to pmlessonslearned.com or download the podcast and grab the files on our Yahoo group. So I'm going to move to slide 2 and talk about some call norms for a moment. This is an interactive call. I do want you to participate, so I don't mind being interrupted at all. A *6 will mute your phone. A *6 will unmute your phone so that you can ask questions and then go back on mute so that we keep the line relatively quiet. You want to just get my attention, and that way we won't talk over each other, but we do love to hear any comments, questions, concerns, whatever. Moving on to the next slide, here's our email address. As I noted before, if you need anything to do with project management, any questions on this group or whatever, pmstudy@pmlessonslearned.com is the email address to get our attention. And then I have some legalese here. The participants on this call and those viewing the PDF file are really meant to use this session as additional study material. So there's a lot of stuff here. You'll see a lot of words, and I'm going to talk around the words. I'm not going to read a slide to you, but I'm going to talk around the words. So you can use this PDF deck as additional study material. And it comes from a Cybex book series published by John Wiley. That series, the new version, is Project Management Professional Study Exam, the 5th edition by Kim Heldman. You see the ISBN number there. You can go buy the book. It is I'm in Massachusetts, just outside of Boston, and in Boston we say it's a wicked good deal for less than $70. You get a study guide, you get a CD with a test engine, some extra tests and whatever. It's a very good deal if you're self-funding your own PMP certification. It's the way to go, and I'm using this material with the permission of the publisher. And with that, we're going to get rolling here, and we're going to be talking about project procurement, and I'm going to move on to the next slide. We're on slide 6 right now. There are a whole lot of different procurement strategies that you will be exposed to in your company, in your organization. And it depends on just how your organization is set up. You'll probably have to deal with some level of corporate strategies. There may be a purchasing department in a larger company. There may not be. You might be in a small company. You never know. So there'll be different types of corporate procurement strategies. There also could be different project procurement strategies, lower level types of things that you get to make up yourself, or maybe in your small group, they have a certain way of doing things as well. So your mileage will vary depending upon the type of environment that you are operating in. Moving on to the next slide, there are objectives that you must pay attention to as you're moving forward. And those objectives will depend on how you are doing your procurements. Are you getting everything from a single source? Are you getting everything from multiple sources? Are you getting a small portion of goods and services from one place or another? Or maybe no procurements at all. In that case, you can hang up because you probably don't need this to do your job, but you do need it for the PMP test. So you can't quite hang up just yet, because you're going to need to know all of these things for the test. And this is one of the knowledge areas that had a decent number of changes over the last version of the PMBOK guide. So there's a whole lot of new things to pay attention to here. Moving on to the next slide, we actually see a map of the knowledge areas, the knowledge area and the various processes that we'll be talking about in this session. We actually have four processes that we'll be talking about. This is an eye chart. This is figure 12-1, I believe, in the PMBOK, so go take a look at it in a version that you can actually see. The intent of this slide here is just to show you that they do exist, and you can get down into the fine detail as we will go through the inputs and outputs, and the tools and techniques of all of these in this session. It'll take roughly an hour, maybe a titch more, to go through that and see how far we get. Moving on to the next slide, let's get in right into the first process area, the first process, I should say. This is the plan procurement process. Its number is 12.1. They're all the processes are numbered. And the numbering sequence, this is the highest number, if you will, and it's the first process, so it's 12.1. We have a whole bunch of inputs here, 11 different inputs that we'll talk about, and just a couple of tools and techniques and a few outputs that we'll pay attention to in the next slides. So moving to the next slide, let's talk about planning procurements. The process is what would you go through is to identify just what it is you're going to be purchasing from an outside organization, whatever that happens to be. Now, sometimes that can be an organization within your own company. There are times in certain companies where you must do procurements from one group to another. So it really is going to depend on where you work, where you are, as to whether you will be following the procurements or not. And what we want to do is make sure that we provide you with what you need to know in order to pass the test, but to help you understand how to do procurements as you're moving on. And one thing, that big red dot at the bottom of the slide there is my way of telling you something to pay attention to, because it's most likely going to be on the exam. We've had a bunch of folks pass the exam in the past few months, and we do some checking to see, you know, what was there, what wasn't there. And in this case, this exam point says the PMBOK guide will always discuss procurement, and the test will always discuss procurement from the buyer's perspective. You are never the seller and on any of the test questions. You're always the buyer. Okay, moving on to slide 11 here. We get into some of the inputs. First is scope baseline. The scope baseline is just as you have done your due diligence with the perform integrated change control process, you have put out a scope statement and done a few other things to make sure that the project has the right scope, the right boundaries in order to move forward. And once that happens, you snap a baseline and you save that off someplace in your records management system that we'll talk about in a few slides from now, so that you know at the start of your project, at the start of your procurement, here's what you had planned to do. Maybe you had planned to buy half of the things that have to go with your project, and where the rubber met the road, maybe you only bought a quarter, or maybe you bought three quarters. It depends on what's going on. But you want to snap that baseline and pay attention to what you thought you were going to be procuring. And you use a scope statement in order to do that. It'll contain everything that you need in order to work through just what it is you're trying to do with your project. You've probably heard of a work breakdown structure. We're not going to get into too much detail with a work breakdown structure in this session. Suffice it to say, it is an organization chart type structure that tells you what you need to do. If you're building a house, you have a picture of an organization structure. The top of the organization chart is building a house. and then the first row of the organization is you have to do site prep work. That's in one tree of the organization chart. Foundation work is in another tree. Electrical work is in another. Framing is in another. And you're putting the structure together. That's a work breakdown structure. It has a dictionary that goes with that. And what that dictionary does is for everything you have underneath those subsections of a work breakdown structure, you've got a description of what they are. It's title, it's a numbering system, it's resources that you think you're going to use, it's specialized equipment, it's things along those lines. It's the description of what it is you're trying to put together. Okay, moving on to the next slide. And then there is requirements documentation. This is what you'll do if you really know you're going out for procurements, you know, what it is you're trying to find, what it is you have to pay attention to, any legal things going on, any contractual things. Maybe there's the safety and health things you have to pay attention to, licenses and permits, things along those lines, any already known given things that you have to pay attention to. Are in the requirements documentation as you're moving forward. Moving on to the next slide. And then there's a new thing called teaming agreements. And this is where there are some type of legal contractual agreement between two or more parties that they're going to form a partnership for in order to produce a specific thing for this project. And this is relatively new for the PMBOK, but it's something that's gone on for a while. There's all kinds of partnerships out there in order to produce projects. And what the PMBOK is saying here is there are normally separate agreements. There can be a separate actual contract to make that happen. So if so, you need to pay attention to that from a procurement point of view as well. Okay, so whenever there's there, make sure you understand what processes you have to follow. It's all in the PMBOK guide and in the study guides. And the exam point down there is when a teaming agreement is used, then the planning processes are significantly impacted because sometimes you might have to do them twice, once for the teaming agreement and then another time for anything else. So there could be some significant impacts as you're moving forward. And maybe you're going to change something because now you're not dealing totally with an internal group. You're partnered with or collaborating with an outside group, and maybe you don't show them everything. It depends on what your agreement is. So you've got to figure that out, and that will impact how you behave as you're going through your project. Looking on slide 14. We have a risk register. We'll talk a whole lot more about risk and risk registers in the risk management session. But basically, a risk register can be as small as a table in a Word document where you've gone through the trials and tribulations of trying to understand where the risk in your project might be. You've made up a table, or maybe it's a whole document, depending upon the scale and scope of your project. But at the very least, it's a table in a document that says, here's a risk that we might see, here's when we might see it, here's what we're thinking about doing to avoid the risk, or maybe we'll accept the risk. Maybe the cost of avoiding it is too large, and you're just going to accept the risk. But here's how we're going to handle the risk, and then maybe you're putting aside some money or some funding in order to cope with that risk, and that's a contingency for later on. And so all these things are in a table called a risk register. I mean, that's all that is. And then there might be, based on whether on your risk, there might be some contract decisions that you have to make. Maybe if a risk happens, you're going to go outside and contract a piece of your project. Or maybe you'll cancel a piece of a project if a risk occurs. See, all these things can interplay, and that's what risk-related decisions is all about. Moving on to the next slide. Then we get into some things I won't spend a whole lot of time on because they are covered in other sessions, but an activity resource requirement is just what do you think you're going to need from a procurement point of view for your project. Do you know you have to go and contract a land moving company for bulldozers and things like that, or specialized equipment, or specialized location, things along those lines? Do you know you're going to need some number of certified public accountants or whatever the case may be? So whatever resource requirement you're going to need. You're going to have a project schedule already made up maybe, so you'll know when you're going to need those resources and when you're not going to need those resources, because you have to release resources from time to time in your project as well. You might already have a cost estimate laid out for those. Maybe you don't, but you will eventually. And you're going to once you have all your costs totaled up, it may not be at the beginning of the project. It could be partway through. But eventually, you're going to know what all your costs are probably going to be, and then you're going to snap yet another baseline. as you work through a project, you can have a half a dozen different baselines for cost and scope and schedule and performance and a whole bunch of other different things. So you'll snap a baseline around your cost as well and use that as an input. So you have a rough idea maybe of what your procurement is going to cost you. Moving on to slide 16. Then we have two things that you're going to see a lot if you're very new to studying for the PMP exam. And those are called EEFs and OPAs, your enterprise environmental factors and your organizational process assets. There's a whole list of stuff there under each one of those. But basically, your enterprise environmental factors is what you have to deal with because you're in the organization that you're in. Certain organizations might only use certain types of suppliers. They might only go with certain terms and conditions for a project. But it's whatever you have to deal with because you're sitting in the chair that you are in that organization that you are in. While an OPA are some of the more tangible things you have to deal with. Maybe you've got in a strong organization where you have had a lot of experienced project managers. There's a repository somewhere with a bunch of checklists, a bunch of policies already laid out, a bunch of sample project plans already done. These are the tangible documents and things you can put your hands on and recycle, reuse as you're going through your project. And oh, by the way, as you go through a project, you should be putting into these OPAs as well, your lessons learned. If you develop the checklist or something like that, you should be putting it back in, and you'll see that in some of the outputs that we'll talk about in a few slides from now. But the OPAs are all those tangible things that help you do your job that other people have put together because you work in the same organization or you found it on the internet or something along those lines. But it's stuff that's already there for you to use and recycle. Moving on to the next slide. Excuse me. Now we're going to get into some tools and techniques for planning procurements. There's basically three of them, and we're not going to talk about the first one at all, much other than to say expert judgment is you talk to the various people around you, the experts who have been there before you have. What did you do to do X, to plan a procurement, plan an event for your civic organization, because remember, projects can be for anything. What did you do to build your garden, to build your birdhouse? You talk to the experts and find out what they did. Doesn't matter the scale or scope. There's a lot of wisdom out there that you should be taking advantage of, and you ask. Some people freely offer. Some you got to chide a little bit, but find out what's been done before you. And then we'll talk about it. Make buy analysis and a little bit about contract types. So moving on to the next slide. As we get into a make-buy analysis, this is where you get to figure out for your specific project, for a specific piece of your project, are you going to build it yourself or are you going to go buy something that's already in existence? And it's relatively straightforward, but it can be kind of convoluted as well. I'm going to show you a quick example of a straightforward one, but it depends on your organization again and what you're going to be doing. And it's not just make-buy. You could lease buy. You could buy or rent. Lease or rent, and if you buy, are you buying domestic, international? We have a flat world now, a flat business world, and you can pretty much buy a lot of goods and services from that cloud of services that's out there nowadays that you can avail on your project. Moving to the next slide. The make decision, if to talk about that for a little bit, is normally less costly, but not always. There are times when it can cost you significantly more to make something than it would be to go buy something that's already in existence. There's a whole lot of people who might know a whole lot more about how to do X than what you do. There's also it's most likely easier to integrate into your operations, because if you're doing it or if you're making it already, then you might already have the wherewithal for the pieces to go into that thing that you're going to make. So maybe your existing operations help you out in that capability. There may be some existing capacity that's idle in your organization, and you're doing a make because you want to put those people to work rather than redirecting them toward the outside somewhere. You can maintain direct control much more easily with a make than you can with a buy, and keep that design integrity and secrecy depending on what's going on. There are a lot of unreputable suppliers out there. There are a lot of good suppliers out there just as well. I'd say there are more good suppliers than there are unreputable ones, but you are unreliable ones. You have to make those decisions, and we'll talk about some ways to do that in a little bit. So now I'm going to move on to the next slide. and talk about the buy decision. Now, with the buy decision, it too can be less costly, but not always. It depends on what's going on. There are a lot of people who may know a whole lot more about how to do one particular thing than you do, so they may be able to provide you with, pre-made birdhouse that you're going to put up 30, 40 birdhouses in your project. Why make 30, 40 birdhouses that'll cost you $500 to do when you can go buy a birdhouse for $10 a piece? You know, it's that type of thing going on. You get to utilize those specialized skills that the suppliers have. And it'll depend upon how much you're going to do and what your capacities are. Maybe you don't have the labor force to do it as well, or you want to keep multiple sources, or you don't want to have direct control. You want to sort of float with the current technology curve, whatever that happens to be. So that's a reason to buy as well. Moving on to slide 21. Here's an example of a make-buy decision. There's a couple of steps to it. I'm simplifying it to two steps. It's obviously more step one. There's a whole lot of stuff in it. I'm calling it step one. But with a make-buy decision, what you've got to do is some homework. You have to figure out if you're going to make this widget that you're going to make, what are your potential outcomes? So if you are looking at the table up on the top, the buy table, if you were to buy this thing, it would cost you $250,000, roughly, in order to buy that widget that you're going to buy. And there's a 70% probability that the amount at stake is $250,000. But there's also a downside to things as well. If you do the buy decision, there's a 30% chance that you're going to lose $20,000. So let me rephrase that first step one. You will make $250,000 if you buy the widget that you're talking about. That's not the cost to make it. That this is a buy. So you're going to have an income of $250,000 if you do the buy. Because you've already scoped things out, and it's much cheaper for you to buy than it is to make. But you're not quite. You want to go through the example in any case. So an income of $250,000 is a 70% probability. A loss of $20,000 with a 30% probability. You multiply those two together, and you get the expected value in that third column. Right. So in the third column, one leg has a $175,000 positive, and the other has a negative. The total. Because everything has to total one. That's why you see total one there. Make sure your probability is total one is $169,000 to the good if you do the buy. Okay. Now we move down to the next set of boxes there and look at the make in this decision. Here we have a 50-50 probability. And if we make it, we stand to also earn a profit of $500,000. Okay, but at the same probability, something could happen that we will lose $150,000. Right, so we're looking at a 50-50 probability in each side of these guys. Now we do the math to get to the third column, and we see $250,000 and minus 75, or for a grand total of a positive $175,000. Okay, so now we do a decision tree. And this is a very simple decision tree. Some decision trees are very complex, but the way you do one is you do a less than sign, big less than sign to start off. You label one leg of that less than sign or sideways V, whatever you want to call that, make. The other one's buy. And then you start filling in another less than sign at the tip of each one of those. And then you're going to do success and failure on the labels on those. And it doesn't matter which one you put on the top, which one you put on the bottom. Just be consistent so you're not confused because one leg is one way and one leg is another way. Then put your numbers in and work through your numbers. And you don't have to use the table up the top if you don't want to. I'm trying to show you two different ways to do things here. If you want to just do it as you're going along, you can certainly follow just step two. But you have to do the numbers. You see the same probabilities, the same gross in income numbers for each one of those, and you see the same outcomes. Following the decision tree step, you find that $175,000 is a higher value than the $169 for the buy decision. So in this case, you would make whatever this widget is because you stand to gain more with a make decision than you do with a buy decision. So with the cash flow we're talking about here is what it costs for the buy decision and for the make as well, is what it's going to cost you to either buy the thing outright, and then you're going to get cash flows coming in, and that $250,000 with a 70% probability is the outcome of expending. Well, it doesn't matter what the number is. You're just looking at the end point, and you do the probabilities, and you pick the highest of the two. It's a very simple way to look at a make-buy procedure. There are significantly more complicated ones, but this gives you the idea, and this is what you need for the test. The test will not get any further than what you're seeing here in a make-buy decision. In fact, they'll probably tell you the grand total is 169 or 175. They might make you do a little bit of math to come out with those things there. That's why I give you the table. Okay, any questions on this before I move on? Okay, with that, we're going to move to slide 22. And with slide 22, we're going to do a very quick rent or lease decision. And let's say you have to put something together that we want to rent some specialized equipment for something that you're doing. And you know that if you were going to rent that specialized piece of equipment, it's going to cost you $100 a day to rent that equipment. You find you can also lease that equipment for $60 a day plus a one-time cost of $5,000. So now, what do you do? You have to do some algebra, is what you have to do, as it turns out. So go back to your 6th, 7th grade algebra class, and we're going to put together a formula. We have to figure out the break-even point. You know how many days you are going to need this piece of specialized equipment. And let's say that number is 150 days you're going to need this specialized piece of equipment. Okay, so we're going to do the formula. If you're going to rent, it's going to cost you $100 a day times X. And if you're going to lease, it's going to cost you a $5,000 upfront charge, and it's going to cost you $60 a day, much less per day. And you solve for X, and you find that X is equal to 125. So you know you need the specialized piece of equipment for 150 days. So that says you should lease the equipment. Why? Because the lease time is more than 125 days. It'll cost you less to lease the equipment than it would to rent it for 150 days at $100 a day. Okay, so it's a very simple type of make-buy, lease-rent type of thing in this case. Okay, so I'm going to move on to slide 23, and we're getting into the outputs now for plan procurements. And we're going to be talking about these few things that you see on the slide right here. So I'm going to move ahead to slide 24. And we'll talk about the procurement management plan. And with the procurement management plan, this is how you think you're going to lay out all of your procurements. So you've spent the time doing the make-buy decision. You've looked at the scope baseline, the inputs that we had in the first few slides. You've gone through your tools and techniques of what you need to put together for make-buy decisions and whatever else you want to pay attention to, and you put a plan together. And it just says, I'm going to do X, Y, and Z, and when, perhaps. And if you want to put a plan together, all the bullets you see in the lower part of the slide are the various pieces that could go into a procurement management plan. They don't have to, but it depends on your organization and what they're looking for in order to do a procurement management plan. Okay. Very good. Now I'm going to move on to slide 25 and talk a little bit more about some of these outputs. Another one is a procurement statement of work. Now, statements of work are basically a document that says what it is you think you're going to do. Just basically states that. Now, you tend to do statements of work in the very beginning of a project. In this case, the develop project charter process, according to the PMBOK. Now, you might have already put one of those statements of work together, and if you happen to be working on a project where you know that 100% of your project or a large percentage of your project is going to be procured, then you've basically done it, because you probably did it with a procurement thought in mind. So you've already, your procurement statement of work is done. You just stick it in it comes out of this process, and you can use it to guide some of your decisions as you work through your plan. It's basically going to describe what it is you're buying, what it is you're leasing, what it is you're doing, so that it's very clear as you work on some of the procurement documents that we're going to be talking about in a couple of slides. Yeah, so just make it sure it's clear, it's concise. Yeah, it should be written in business terms to a great extent, so that you can pay attention to the business side of things. But sometimes they have to post, you have to have technical areas that in your statement of work as well. You put enough in there to get the job done is the point. Moving on to the next slide. We've already talked about make buy decisions, but this is the actual decision. We decided to buy. So we now know we're going to go buy. Hence, we have a procurement that we have to pay attention to. So these are the actual outcomes. Okay, and then there are change requests, because every now and again, you're going to change something, or perhaps pretty constantly, you're going to change something. It depends on your organization. Some organizations, they have to plan, and then implement, so there's nothing going on. Some do a little bit at a time. It depends on your organization, but change requests happen, and you need to make sure you have a process to deal with that. That's done over in Perform Integrated Change Control, something we talked about last podcast we did for this session. So there's where all those change control things come in. But the request or the idea that they have to change something is what this point is all about. Oh, something has to change. We need to write it up. Moving on to the next slide, there's some other outputs or other procurement documents. And there's a whole bunch of different things around procurement documents. You need to be aware of just what type of document you need to use. There are things called requests for proposals, requests for information for bid, another set of alphabet soup. And which one you use depends upon what you're trying to do. Are you focused on price? Or are you focused on some sort of technology or content? It's a better way to say that. Whatever it is, you want to make sure it very clearly says what you're looking for, because what these things are, you're going to advertise these. There are websites out there where you can post your RFP or IFB, whatever it is you're going to do, in order to solicit responses from vendors to provide what it is you're looking for. And there are trade magazines, depending upon what industry or what they're with. You're a municipality or something like that. If you're a state and you have to build roads and bridges and things along those lines, there are magazines and things like that for the contractors that do that type of thing. And as I mentioned, there's categories you need to pay attention to. If price is the only thing you're going on, you want staples. You know, staples are it's a standard commodity. You need staples, you need pencils, you need whatever. And price is the main thing you're paying attention to, then the vehicle you would use to solicit the bids is an IFB or an RFQ, an invitation for bid or request for quotation. Just give me your price. Now, you want to give me some description of what it is? Yeah, I'll take that too, but it's price I'm mainly interested in. But if something else, technology, a specific approach, you want only a green approach, you want only a certain ethnic approach, whatever that might be, then you do a proposal format. So a request for proposal is what you would use there. And the people who will respond know that if they see RFP, then it's not just price you're paying attention to, but if they see RFQ, they know that it's price you're trying to pay attention to. So you, for the test, need to pay attention to those difference in terms. And that bids or quotations they use when price is what you're paying attention to, or in proposals and proposals is what you're paying attention to when you are looking for something other than price. The proposals is what you pay attention to. Okay, moving on to the next slide. And then there's a whole set of documents. As you're going through this, you've got your RFP and your RFQs. You've got your make-buy decisions. You've got your documentation, your procurement plan. All that stuff becomes your procurement documents. And what you're going to do now is advertise all of these things and place all these documents that say, here's what I'm going to do and when, and you stick those into your records management system so that it is documented exactly what you're going to use. And we'll talk about record management systems in a few slides from now. And then another output is source selection criteria. So as you're going through the process, you put your quotations out, you're going to get some number of solicitations back. How do you pick which one you want to use? Before you do the advertisement for the bids, you should already come up with a way that you're going to rank and rate any proposals that come back so you can pick one. And that's what this is all about. What criterion are you going to use? Moving on to the next slide. There's a ton of things you can use, And it depends on what your project is. You see on this slide a whole list of different things. This could be technical ability. You want only leading edge type of technical ability. Or on the other end, you want only tried and true technology. You don't want anything bleeding edge. You want a certain management approach. You want to make sure that the vendor is listed in some stock exchange or something along those lines. Be a business of a certain type of revenue, so many billions of dollars annual revenue, something along those lines. Someone who's used to handling intellectual property rights, whatever the case may be. Or maybe you want to ask for a certain set of references. It can vary, and you'll be the one to determine which of those criteria you're going to use. Moving on to the next slide. And that's it for that process. Now we move on to conduct procurements. And we pay attention to a few things here. We get 9 different inputs here. We've got 7 tools and techniques, and we have 6 different outputs we'll pay attention to. So let's get right into it and look at the first set of inputs. What we're talking about here is what we're mainly interested in is obtaining the bids, obtaining the responses coming back. We want to collect them. As we did our advertisement, we would say reply by such and such a date to such and such an email address, a snail mail address, whatever the case may be. You'll be receiving binders and notebooks and PDF files and all those types of things. And what you need to figure out is you're going to take all these and you're going to do certain things with them to make sure that it's all set up. And these are the things that you're going to be paying attention to as we look at the various inputs. Let's go to the next slide and start that. So first we talk about a qualified seller or qualified vendor list. A lot of companies have these. These are the preferred vendors, if you will. And if you're in an established organization, maybe you've already set up a relationship with a particular vendor for something. If it's staples, if it's pencils, whatever the case may be, there may be a blanket purchase order. Sometimes if somebody is on the qualified vendor list, it's very easy to buy from them. Why? Because you almost already have a pre-approved purchase order to do that. It eliminates a lot of the red tape involved in making a purchase because this particular vendor has already agreed to a certain set of terms and conditions, and it's just a matter of how much, how many they're going to be providing. Or if it's something, a bigger part of your project, maybe they're drafting services or documentation services or something along those lines, and they've done work for you before, and it's just a matter of scoping out the size of your document, but you have a proven track record with this company. So if you have a project that requires those types of documentation services, you've got a pretty well standard way of going to get those. You just call, if they're on the qualified vendor list, you see them there, and you just call them up and say, I need X. They'll tell you how much it's going to be, and you're done. You've done your procurement. All the legal stuff is taken care of by the purchasing department, because that's why those QVLs exist. It's most likely done by your purchasing or your procurement department in a larger organization. But if you're in a small organization, maybe not, but the concept is still the same. These are the people you go to a lot in order to do your procurements. And on the next slide, that's pretty much all the inputs we need to worry about. That was the only new thing that we hadn't really talked about yet. So now we're going to move on to tools and techniques. And here we got a few new things that we have to pay attention to. And the first is bidder conferences. So let's move on to the next slide. Excuse me. And we'll talk about bidder conferences. These are actual meetings where if you've got a large project and you've put out for bids and you've received back, I don't know, 15 or 20 different proposals, you have to have some way to whittle those down, to eliminate the ones that you don't want. And sometimes you can't just do it from a book. You have to meet them face-to-face or whatever. That's what a bidder conference is all about. You will set a date, you'll set a time, you'll set a place, and maybe you'll set a schedule. So vendor A comes in from 9 to 10, vendor B sits in front of you from 10 to 11, and you go work through the day with that schedule. But all the while in the background, there are other people around that will provide a summary of the project. They'll provide you a summary of your company to these people, and you'll begin to understand who they are and find out what it is they do, and they can find out a bit more about you other than in that 1 hour or however many hour face-to-face conversation that you're going to be having with them. You're going to probably have something else set up. I participated in quite a few vendor conferences over the years for various things, and it wasn't unusual for us to bring in four or five different vendors and put on a dog and we'll call it a dog and pony show for them. We'll have a general presentation a couple times a day to say what it is we're looking for, what it is we're doing, allow them to ask questions, and then they get one-on-one FaceTime for that hour during the day. That's a bitter conference. There's also proposal evaluation techniques. So we set the criteria back in the last process. Now we're actually going to use that criteria in order to move forward. And then there's waiting systems. Part of the criteria they're going to be putting together is for certain aspects of your project, what's more important to you? Is a certain technical factor more important? Is a certain more soft factor more important to you? You have to figure out all of that, and then pay attention to those as you are looking through and evaluating the bids. You're going to, some things are important to you, some things not so much. And there are also independent estimates. These are where you're not sure how much something is supposed to cost. So you go and you ask that expert judgment that I talked about earlier. Also, there are services that will provide you with an estimate for widget A for in this type of context. It should cost you roughly from here to there. That's an independent estimate of what's going on. If you are a good example, I recently used getting one of my automobiles fixed. I had some front end work that needed to be done. There's a website called RepairPal.com. If you're near a screen somewhere, you go there. You tell them to make a model of your car, what you need done, where you're located, and it'll give you a range of what that should cost. That's that independent estimate of what it's going to cost you, and that way you'll know whether any of the proposals you're getting back are have merit, or are they all way high or way low, and if so, why is that? You'll have to figure that out, and then you use those things as screening systems, and work through some if there's certain performance things you have to pay attention to. If you're working on a transaction processing system, you know, what's the speed? How many transactions per second? How many if you're doing a nailing machine? How many nails per minute can that nailing machine drive, or something along those lines? You put these screens in place to weed out the things that you don't want. So you're only really paying attention to the proposals that have some merit that you really want to consider. Moving on to the next slide. Here's an example of a weighted scoring model. In this case here, there are 1, 2, 3, 4 different things we're paying attention to, from platform down to custom modules and training. We're on slide 37 here, and you see the weight for each one. Platform is more important, whatever platform is in this example. And then hardware, and then data conversion, and then custom modules. Obviously, this is a software or a systems package that they're paying attention to from an IT point of view. So you see the weight there. And then you have all your vendors lined up, and somebody in your team rates vendor A, B, C, and D from a scale of 1 to 5 on the platform. And you do the math. You see a 15 under vendor A. So vendor A rated a 3. 3 times 5 is 15. That's why, how do you get the 15? Vendor B rated a 2. 2 times 5 is 10. And you can do the math of the rest of that line and the rest of the table. When you get down to the bottom of the table, you total them up. And theoretically, the vendor with the highest score wins. But this is only taking into account these four factors. Now you've got to say, okay, so for the weighting model, this vendor won. But is there some other driving thing that you need to pay attention to in order to make your final selection? That will depend on you and your company and your project. Okay, moving on to other tools and techniques here. We already talked about independent estimates. They will also hear them called should cost estimates. So you might see on the test should cost estimates as well. And that's expert judgment, as I said. So sometimes you pay for it, sometimes it's free. It depends on what you're trying to do. And there's advertising. As you're going out and conducting your procurement, you have to do some advertising. You have to let them know that you're looking for proposals. and that'll be on a website, maybe your own company website, maybe you're going to hook into a professional website for bridge building. You want to need a bridge done, and there are places to do that, professional journals, as I mentioned. And just do a plain old internet search. If it's something that's more commodity-ish that you're looking for, the internet's a marvelous thing nowadays. You can find a lot of stuff there that you need, and a whole lot of stuff you don't, too. Moving on to the next slide. Then we're talking about some negotiations now. This is to the point now where you're probably getting ready to do some serious talking to some folks. You want to find out where their heads are at. And you come to some type of agreement regarding contract terms before you've worked through all of your waiting and your selection. You come down to one or two, most likely one, and now you want to see how they're going to fare in a negotiation. So you start working out terms, price, responsibility, whatever the case may be, and you're going to work this. You can also work this as a separate process in and of itself. There are a lot of classes out there around negotiations and how to do negotiations. There are a lot of theories and strategies and outcomes, depending on what you're going to do. In fact, the brain dump that I keep talking about from time to time has a table in there. If you're doing a negotiation and you're applying one of the six different negotiation strategies and your opponent is also applying one of those six, who's going to win? Or do you end up with a stalemate, or do you end up with resolution? When a resolution is both parties come away happy. One party does not have to lose. You can both come away happy. But sometimes parties will use certain strategies and certain techniques, and one you probably see on the test is called fait accompli. And that means fact realized or accomplished, and it's where one party says, well, I think we're done with that. Let's move on. And you're really not. They're trying to blow smoke at you. You're trying to blow smoke at them, whatever the case may be. You're trying to make it seem like there's an agreement already, or there's a fact already in existence that really isn't. So just pay attention to that somebody might try a fait accompli strategy in a negotiation. Moving on to the next slide, we'll talk about the outputs. Here, the output is who'd you choose? That selected seller. It's the winner of the process. And they get it. They are awarded a contract. That's the next one. And contracts have several names. It could be an agreement. It could be a memorandum of understanding. It depends on the industry you work in and what standard for that industry. Okay, moving on to the next slide. There are also things called resource calendars. So everything's got a calendar nowadays. Even vendors, even tractors and bulldozers have calendars. Is it spoken for on such and such a day at such and such a time? So everything has a calendar. You need to know what the commitments you need from that vendor are so you can work them in. And the vendor needs to know as well because they have to say, yeah, I can do that in that time frame. All right? So that's what a resource calendar is all about. And then we have a couple of quickies. Change requests we've already talked about. Project management plan updates is whatever you found that you have to do in order to update your project management plan should it need to, and any project documents that you might have, any updates to anything. Maybe you've created a new this or a new that you need to pay attention to. All right. And that's the end of that one, and now we'll move on to administer procurements, which is process number 12.3. We've got six different inputs, seven different tools and techniques, and four different outputs for that guy. So move on to the next slide. We'll talk about administer procurements. And this is what you do. You've already made your decision. You've got things signed. Now you're actually doing your day-to-day work with whoever you've chosen. And you have to look and see how they are performing and making sure that everything is the way you expect it to be. Eventually, you have to pay them, and depending upon how your schedule for payment is worked out. It might be at the end, it might be during the beginning, during the middle, it might be installments is the word I was looking for, as you're moving forward. It depends on what you're trying to do. As you also are administering procurements, if you have more than one vendor, sometimes they are going to have to interact. And you need to make sure that you facilitate that interaction. Make sure they know that they're going to interact with another vendor. It's not you, it's somebody, it's another vendor. What are their schedules? Can vendor A, something vendor A does might impact vendor B, so they better be aware of that, and so they can make sure they work out any kinks and make sure things flow smoothly. And the more vendors you have, the more convoluted this can be. So just be aware that you have to pay attention to it. And it's imperative that you are aware of any contract agreements or anything along those lines that uh, that uh, may want to try to make sure your team is aware of any contract stipulations in the agreement so that they don't do anything that's going to violate an agreement or any kind of contract. So your team members need to be aware of what's going on as well. Moving on to slide 44. Now we're talking about a few other inputs. We've already talked about procurement documents and project management plans. And we also have a contract. I'll call it a piece of paper, but it can be something other than paper as well. But you're going to award that to each side of the seller you've chosen, and it can be in any type of form. It can be totally electronic. Nowadays, it can be a single page, a simple purchase order, or a very complex document. Depends on what you want to do, and there's a whole bunch of different things that can have in it. It's a whole bunch of different gazintas, and you see in that table down below the different sections it could have. I'm not going to get into all of those, but these are just some of the things that you can have in a contract. And you have to remember, this is a legal binding document that is subject to penalties and things like that, depending on how you've written it. So subject to court scrutiny should dispute arise. And so you have to pay attention to all those types of things. And moving on to the next slide. As you're administering your procurement, you have to be aware of how your vendors are doing. So they're going to provide you with performance reports, or you're going to solicit performance reports from them, whatever the case may be. How are they doing? Where are they? How far along are they in the project? Are they on schedule, off schedule? How much have they spent? That type of thing. All depends on how your contract is written, and you'll need to pay attention to those types of things as well. Okay. And then as we move through, we see approved change request. Now, this is one where you've requested something in one of the earlier processes or even earlier in this knowledge area. It's been approved by whatever approval scheme you have to pay attention to, and now it's come back. It can maybe modify one of your contracts. So you need to make sure that any change to your contract you're aware of, excuse me, and you cover those things so that you're not surprised and your vendor's not surprised as well. Maybe you've already talked about it, and you really don't want anything undocumented because those can hurt you later on. Try to document as much of this stuff as you possibly can. Moving on to slide 46. A bit more about work performance information. It's how they're doing. Relatively straightforward. It's really to pay attention to here the output of the direct and managed project execution process. That's where it's really coming from. So another process is providing this. There's a whole lot of interaction inside of the different processes in the PMBOK, as I'm sure you are aware. And the exam point here is you're actually going to gather the outputs here from the direct and managed execution process. This is where you put them together, make sure you understand what they've done, and you're going to do some level of analysis. Is this where you're supposed to be? Yep. Okay, fine. And you move on. But they're collected in a different process and used here. That's the point to pay attention to there. So it's whatever plan, whatever cost schedules you're working against, you make sure that they know what they are and how you're coming. That's all that is. If you happen to have part of your agreement, once you hit a certain deliverable, a certain trigger, a certain time frame, you might have to pay an invoice. That's what this is all about here. When you talk about work, seller invoices as part of work performance information. Depending on your contractor, the vendor is going to request a payment for something in one form or another that you need to pay attention to. You should be aware of what those stipulations are so you're not surprised when the request comes along. And for the exam points you see here, you have to remember that these invoices are an element of the work performance information input, and they are not an output, so to speak. So as it's an input coming in. So just be aware that is there. And don't confuse seller invoices with a payment system. This is the payment system is yet another tool that you'll be using in a little bit. You'll see that. But this is just an input. It's not the actual work being done. Moving on to slide 48. Now we'll get into those tools and techniques that I was just talking about a moment ago. Moving on to the next slide. First, we'll talk about a contract change control system. You should have written into your contract methods for doing changes, who can change them, how much they can change them, and when. Make sure that is all together because it's a legal document. and you have to have agreement up front on how things are going to be done. So you should have a method already laid out, as I mentioned, for making changes, and make sure that it is followed. Because if you don't, you could have a dispute, and if you have a dispute, it's nothing but pain for the most part, unless you've got a really laid out, well laid out contract, and you just follow the letter of the contract, and you're done. But sometimes it's not that simple. So just be aware of all that. And this change control system, as I mentioned earlier, is down in the Perform Integrated Change Control Processes process that happens much earlier in the PMBOK. Moving on to the next slide, we have procurement performance reviews. So you're going to let your seller know, you'll let your vendor know how they're doing. Is there something you like? Is there something you don't like? And what is that? So that they can improve, or if they're doing fine, great. Just keep on, do that again. That was really good. Keep that type of thing coming. You should always do performance reviews in any project. Some organizations don't do them so well, so often, whatever the case may be. But it's good to let your vendors know how they're doing, because it's a yardstick for them. It lets them know what they need to improve on, and how quickly they're going to be paid in some instances, things along those lines. Just make sure that you provide them with some good regular performance reviews. Moving on to the next slide. Every now and again, you're going to have to inspect what's going on. So especially if they're providing more of a widget type of thing instead of a service, but you can still inspect a service as well. You can look and see what's happening. So as a tool and technique, if you want to make sure you can inspect, you can audit as things move on, and that's basically an inspection. If it's a physical, tangible thing, you can physically inspect a tangible thing. If it's a service, you can still inspect a service. You can still look at the requirements of the service. Maybe you have a service level agreement that you've had in place. You can go by that as your tangible thing and see if the vendor is meeting the service levels that they said they were going to do. And then there's performance reporting. You yourself are going to take all the vendor's stuff, that their performance that they've given you, and you are going to provide your own performance reports as well to your stakeholders and your management chain. That's what that's all about. And then we get into payment systems. That invoice that you picked up as an input from Direct and Manage, now you got to pay that. So these are actually the processes that you're going to be using to issue a payment. These are the processes and tools and techniques you'll be using to issue a payment for the submitted seller invoices, and it's whatever process your organization uses. Moving on to the next slide. And then there's claims. Every now and again, something happens where something's not right, and it needs to be tweaked, and then maybe there's a contested thing someplace. Well, you said this, no, I said that type of thing. If that's the case, if you have a really good, a really well-written contract, it'll tell you what you need to do in order to resolve the issue, whatever that claim might be. But from time to time, it's not. If you have one of these claims and it isn't spelled out in the contract how to do with it, it becomes a dispute, becomes an appeal or such. And there's different ways to settle that. If you cannot come to an agreement, you try to work it out. There are ways to re-enter negotiations, try to work it out. But if you can't, for whatever reason, there's other things that you can do. You can go to the court system, or you can use arbitration in order to work through there, or mediation. Arbitration, though, is you guys just can't come to an agreement, so you're going to go to an objective, disinterested third party. There are people who are registered arbiters, and it's their job. They look at both sides. They make a decision that is legally binding. Because going into arbitration, both sides agree to be bound by whatever the arbiter decides. So you don't have to go to court. So court systems can be kind of lengthy. This is quick, but it's not cheap. So you get long and cheap, or quick and expensive. But either way, you get resolution. So pick whatever one you want to do, and then move forward. And that's what arbitration is all about. Moving on to slide 53, then we have that records management system that I keep talking about. And this can be a wide range of things. It can be a box in the corner of the room. It can be a file cabinet. It can be a notebook. It can be a fancy computer system like Hewlett-Packard, where I work, sells. It can be a whole lot of different things. It depends on your company, your organization. You need some place to keep your documentation. This is where it all goes. And just keep tracker and have it indexed, have it set up somehow where you can find things relatively easily, and make sure that it's set up so that if you have to go back to it for something, you're able to. Moving on to slide 54, we're getting into the outputs here. And a lot of these we've touched on already. We've talked about procurement documentation. I'm going to move on to the next slide, and you see that there are a few different types of things here, some of which we talked about, some of which we haven't, but we already know procurement documentation is anything involved with a procurement. So maybe it's the contract, maybe there's some warranty documentation you have to pay attention to. Supporting schedules, or if you've done a lot of audits and things like that, or inspections, you need to put the results of those. You've got control charts, you've got Ishikawa diagrams or whatever, because you worked on an issue or something like that. All this stuff goes in there. And that's the best place to keep all this stuff. Moving on to slide 56. And then one of the OPAs that we have is a payment schedule and request. So here is a situation where you've got some there, you need an OPA, remember, all the checklists and things like that you should pay attention to. So most likely there might be something already set up in the in your company that you can use. So you just basically use whatever payment schedule they have in the past for a similar type of project. And that's why you see this OPA here. There's just what you've done in the past. And the PMBOK says that this payment schedule and requests have certain, they pertain to the payment systems that are external to the project. So if you have to do an external pay a vendor, this is when this comes in, or you have to pay a certain organization if you got one of those funky agreements where you have to consider some internal group as a vendor. This is where you kick these types of things in. And then as you're going through and actually making the payments, the output is actually called payments. How about that? So you've actually got something that actually means something. Okay, moving on to the next slide. And we can talk a little bit more about some of the OPA updates. Correspondence is a good thing to hold on to. So as you're working through your project, various emails, everything pretty much is in an email nowadays. Maybe you'll get something on a piece of paper, but everything is electronic. Is what I'm trying to say here. So maybe you have a hard drive set up or a folder on your hard drive in your computer or on your or PC if it's a small project or a larger computer. You have a whole storage array set up, and it's totally separate. The reason why you do that is if you get into some of these arbitration suits or some of these disputes, there are times when you have to do discovery. And if you've got your project documentation, your correspondence strewn all over the place, that opponent that you're facing in the dispute can go anywhere on your computer to find those things. So you keep those things. We heard in probably 2 months ago, there was one of the third Thursday of the month PM Lessons Learned calls. The presenter talked about what to do in that type of thing, and he suggested if you've got a PC, use a separate hard drive. If you've got a big company, use a separate storage array or something you can separate from the system, and so it's all in one spot. So if you get into discovery, then it's easy to separate, and you don't have to show everything to everybody. And then seller performance evaluation is in there. You might want to use that to input to your qualified vendor list that we talked about quite a few slides ago. There's all kinds of things that you can use to put all these things together and make sure that you keep the vendors that are really good, that you really like, that can do what you want and do it well, and the other ones you tend to dump because you don't like them, and you have a bad seller list as well. Don't ever use company, the Acme rug company ever again. They just aren't that good. And that's what all the seller performance evaluations are all about. Moving on to the next slide. You will get change requests into your friend as part of your outputs for the administrator procurements process quite often. And as you find something needs to be changed, you submit the documentation. Make sure you've done your due diligence and you provided all the information that's required. And it goes down into the direct managed execution process and a perform integrated change control process where it actually gets either approved or worked on, depending on which one you're hitting at any given point in time. But you're paying attention to those things so that you know what your change requests are and you have no surprises when something changes all of a sudden. And then, of course, you're going to have project management plan updates from time to time as things change. You've updated your schedule. You've snapped a new baseline for one reason or another. Maybe some of those changes cause you to cause a big whole lot of pain for you, and you've got to make some major changes. That's where you make your project management plan update changes. Moving on to the next slide. And we're finally on the last process. This is closed procurement. It's not very big, as you can see, so we're going to move on here to slide 60. And with closed procurements, it's this is pretty much concerned with getting everything finished, completing, settling everything down, making sure that everything is all the outputs, all the deliverables you wanted from that vendor are actually in-house now. You actually have something tangible, or if it's a service that you've contracted with, the terms of that service are completed. The service might either being retired or you're moving on to another vendor. Doesn't matter. You've received everything you need to from those folks, and you've made sure your procurement documentation understands that and it states all the right things, so that when you get to the closed project or phase process and such, you're able to work through that relatively efficiently. Also, during the closing project, this is where you find if you're in a weak matrix organization, these have the least amount of stress. Why? Because the people working the project already have another gig lined up. They already know what they're going to be doing. And because the functional manager in a weak organization takes care of their own people. And the same can happen with a vendor as well. This vendor may already have something lined up to cover when they're not working with you anymore. So the vendors can have a lower amount of stress with some of these situations as well. But the PMP exam could ask you that type of question: where is the least amount of stress for everybody found? And that's in the closed procurements process. So we look at a couple of quick inputs here. We already know about the project management plan, so I won't talk too much about that. We know we've got some level of documentation, and we've been producing as we've gone along here to make sure that we have everything that we need. And so we have all our documentation set up, and this is all in the record management system, so we know where everything is. And the exam point down there is this is an input to both the closed project or phase and the closed procurement processes as well. So we just sort of be aware that this the procurement documentation is here. And then we talked about the records management system already. It's that same box, file cabinet, huge honking computer system, whatever it is. And then here's a new one now, procurement audits. We sort of done some other audits, some initial working our way through, but now at the end, you also want to make sure, are you going to do an audit at the very end? You get to choose that or not. If you've done significant audits throughout the process, maybe you don't need an ending one. Maybe you already know what's there. It's up to you in your particular project to determine whether you want to do one final audit as you're working through here. The two exam points we see here is that the PMBOK guide says procurement audits are concerned with reviewing the process. This is not to review the product that you are put in on, that you've been working on. So this is, hey, did this process work? Because you've already done your other audits way before, remember. Now what we're talking about is, did this process work for you? Did you like the way you did this particular procurement? Do you want to do it again this way, or do you want to change it a little bit? Right, so that's what this one is all. This procurement audit is all about, and the primary purpose of this is to identify lessons learned. Yeah, we like this vendor. Let's use them again. That's a really good lesson, or maybe an even better lesson is, no, this vendor was terrible. Let's never use them again because they didn't know what they were doing, whatever the case may be. But it's to help you figure out what it is you're going to do and to build those lessons learned for the people who are coming behind you. You are now the expert. You've been through one project. You are now the expert that the people behind you are coming to for information, for help. And then, excuse me. Then we have something called a negotiated settlement. And that gets back into some of the dispute things we were talking about earlier. And with a negotiated settlement, there's a thing called an alternative dispute resolution technique. that you can use. And they're calling it the most favorable method to resolve a dispute. It's also called arbitration that we talked about earlier, you know, or some other thing that you want to use. It's just an alternative, whatever you want to choose to use it as an alternative to whatever the contract says. You know, figure out what works for you and try to use it is what that's all about. And for outputs for closed procurement, we basically just have the procurement itself is now done as an output of this process. You're no longer required to use that vendor. Everything is done. You've collected all the deliverables that vendor was going to provide. You've done your audit to make sure the process worked for you, and you want to use it again or you don't want to use it again. You want to use this vendor again or not. And all these things are together. It's all in your documentation. It's all in your record management system. You've captured your lessons learned and everything else. And then you're going to terminate the contract by whatever method the contract stipulates. You should always stipulate how you want to do that. And hopefully it's by default because the contract is over. But it can be for cause as well because things just didn't work out, and you're going to terminate the contract for cause because something just didn't work for you. And moving on to the next slide, other things that go into your OPAs are the updates. You've got your procurement file, that's that box and such. Another way to state that box name. You've also got deliverables that you're accepting at the very end of your project, things that you need to make sure that they're here. Most of that has around financial things for the most part, but there could be some tangible things you have to worry about as well. So you're worried about all of that. And then finally, your lessons learned. That goes into your file cabinet as well. We always want to capture whatever lessons learned we can because, as I mentioned, you are now the expert with this particular project, this particular vendor, and people are going to be asking what you think. And then finally, in practice, there's a few things need to happen. It used to be the PMBOK stated that you needed to close the project or phase, you had to close all of your the project before you closed your procurements out. They no longer state that anymore. That got a lot of people's heads spinning around. Why would you close your project before you close your procurement? So now you can do it in whatever order you want. The PMBOK will not be a test question. That used to be a test question. Almost guaranteed that will be on a test someplace. You have to remember you had to close your project, then close your procurements. They're not going to ask that question anymore. But for you to know in practice, you're most likely going to close out your procurement and then do your final documentation for your project. Probably 80% of the time you'll do it that way. Sometimes you'll have to do it the other way. But for the most part, you work your own project the way you want is the main thing here. And whatever you do, make sure that that contract file that you have, the contract document ever, shows up in your procurement documentation so that you can keep track of it for the next project. And with that, I am done with the presentation. I will ask folks to *6 your phone to unmute your phones for any questions you might have. And then we can sort of chit-chat toward the end if there's anything else we need to cover. Are there any questions before we go in any further? Went through a lot of stuff tonight.
Yeah, Dana, this is Judy.
Hey, Judy.
you're with a large company and you have a lot of vendors, generally on products. Do you classify them A, B, C, and do you have a process where you systematically, regularly give them performance reviews?
Absolutely. Absolutely. Now, I will say that HP has a lot of different divisions, and each division will vary depending upon what's going on, but we also have a global supply chain organization that tries to do a lot of that type of work and will sometimes dictate to the divisions. You know, because our volume division that does the laptops and things along those lines has different business philosophies than the huge honking enterprise systems for good reason. So the global supply organization in HP will try to dictate more than say Joe's feed store will try to dictate vendors coming in and doing things. So it really depends on your organization. But yes, large organizations, you will see the categorization. You will see a lot of formality around vendor management because it's a huge portion of the cost of doing business. So we
want it's written into the contract.
And it's written into the contract, absolutely. Okay. Or it's written into the qualified vendor list. We have for various divisions qualified vendor lists for certain types of components. So we know that if we're building a circuit board for X or we're trying to get some machine tool parts or something along those lines, if you choose vendor A who's on a qualified vendor list, you have to go through a couple orders of magnitude less red tape and less pain than you do someone who's brand new. But there might be reason for bringing somebody new in. It all depends on what you're trying to do.
Okay. Thank you.
Sure. Any other questions?
Is this Krishna here?
Go ahead.
Yeah. I have a question about, do you need to know about various types of contracts for the exam?
It's for the types of contracts. That's actually going to be in another session. It's a very good question. There are several types of contracts that are there are fixed price contracts. There are variable price contracts. There are contracts with time and materials. There's too much. I'm going to do an hour just on contracts because there's so much there to do. I'm glad you asked that question. Because there are just so many things there. You know, this presentation would be 2 hours long. In fact, in the internal version of this presentation that I do for this study group, PMP study groups that I run inside of AHP, the sessions are 2 hours long, and I actually provide that contract piece. There are many different types of contracts, each with their different risk categories. We could do a very quick summary here, where a fixed price contract is better for the buyer because the buyer knows what his price is. It's more risky for the seller because the seller has to cover all of their costs and make a profit. So you see a couple of different variants. You might see fixed price plus incentive, where the buyer knows it's going to cost him X amount for the project, but there's incentives for the seller. So if they finish earlier than expected, maybe there's an extra amount of money in it for them or something along those lines. That helps the seller. So if they do better on the contract, they get more money for it. Or if there's a penalty, if they don't do so well, then they have to pay a penalty as well. Then there's variable price contracts where you're paying for by the day or whatever the price, the case may be, by the deliverable. A lot of times you see a contract by the deliverable. There it's much more risky for the buyer, much less risky for the seller because the risks are being shared more or less. The buyer could wind up, if the seller takes longer than expected to do something, the buyer is going to have to eat some of that cost of that risk. So buyers tend not to want to do variable price contracts unless they want to go to the ultimate variable price contract, which is a time and materials contract. You pay X amount per dollar, per week, per month for a resource. You pay X amount for the materials. That way, it all depends on how much of each you want to use, and the buyer can sort of control that to some extent, depending upon what they're doing. But they can certainly take the time to make sure that they can figure out how much of each of those types of things they're going to need in order to spend the amount of money they were looking for to get the contract to be completed. So those are some. So some of the types of contracts. I'm going to spend an hour. I just spent 2 minutes doing it. I'm going to do
Sure. In that scenario, like for example, if you're outsourcing a software project, what kind of contract would you use? Like a variable contract with an incentive? Is my assumption correct?
I would say yes. I think that is the type of contract that most organizations most selling organizations will try to do. I think as a buyer, I would want to try to do a fixed price whenever I can possibly can. But if that being the case, that the vendors want to share some of the risk, then the fixed price with an incentive is the next best step. It's a little bit more risky for the for the buyer, but you know what the risk is. You know that if they come in, say they finished a project 1 month early, it's an extra $10,000 for them or $10 million or whatever the case may be. You can budget that. So if the vendor does finish early, then you know that you have that money in your budget and you can pay it. So it's riskier, but you can plan for that. And the same with the seller, it's less risky for them because they know if they really work hard and come in earlier, they can get an extra $10 million, whatever it is. But and so that's what you'll see. I think you're right. A lot of contracts are the fixed price plus incentive, but there are just as many that aren't for various reasons, depending upon the industry you're talking about and the type of project as well.
For the software, is it fixed or
is it
variable?
I think most of the contracts you'll see out there from a buyer's point of view. Remember, the PMBOK, the PMP exam is from a buyer's point of view. So for the exam, you'd always want to default to a fixed price contract.
Okay.
So to answer the question that way, from the exam point of view, fixed price is the way you want to go.
For the buyer.
For the buyer, remember the exam's always going to be for the buyer. Good point, Judy.
Yep.
They're always going to be looking at things from the buyer's point of view, never from the seller's point of view.
Yeah.
On the exam.
As project manager, you are working with the purchasing department and the legal department in negotiating the contracts. You don't go and negotiate. Do you sit in on the negotiations?
It depends on the size of your organization. If you are in a division where you are trying to produce a new thing for that division, yeah, you probably would sit in on it if you're the project manager for that. But if you're in a very large thing, like how many NASA project managers sit in on those negotiations? Probably not too many. So then you're going to have somebody else who's going to be sitting in. You might have a negotiator. That's all their job is sitting in on negotiations. They have their set of goals and absolutes. That's another negotiating tool and technique is the goal and absolute. They know what they're supposed to be achieving in the negotiation. And then the paid negotiator does the work and the project manager does not. Depends on the size of your organization and the scope. I've seen it both ways.
Does a legal aspect always involve in a contract?
For the most part, yeah, unless if there's a handshake. If there's a handshake, that can be a contract as well if both parties agree to that. Now, the problem with a handshake contract, it's not legally binding, so you can walk away if you want. It's your word as a human that you're going to fulfill what you said you were going to do. So it depends on the receiving party if they're going to accept your word and move on. But from business to business, you'll never see a word-of-mouth contract. It's always going to be a written document. It's always going to be legal. It's always going to be fully negotiated. Sometimes the terms and conditions are not so good for one side or the other, but that's a negotiator's problem. It's not your issue necessarily. So you have to pay attention to those types of things. Make sure you have your negotiator, whoever's doing your negotiations, set up to achieve the goals that you want and the absolutes that you want in your negotiations. And they know all the strategies and techniques in order to achieve that type of thing in a negotiation.
Thank you.
So it should always be, to answer the question that I did the long answer, the short answer is yes, a contract should always be written, and it's always a legal document. So there's a short answer for the test. Any other questions?
This is great. Thank you so much, Dana.
You're very welcome. You're very welcome. Let me take some time. Let me do my outro here, and then we'll handle any other questions. So, for those unaware, I mentioned earlier in the session that if you're just coming onto the call after a little while, we have three calls per month. The first of the month is the PMP study group call that we're in right now, the podcast you're listening to right now. The second Thursday of the month is the PM Lessons Learned Job Shop. The third call is the PM Lessons Learned conference call that provides a variety of different project management topics. So that's basically it for this session of the PM Lessons Learned Monthly PMP Exam Study Group Call. I'll thank all the live participants again for their participation and their questions, and I'll thank everyone that downloads the podcast as well when that's available. And I'll remind you that we are PMLessonsLearned.com, project managers helping project managers to make a difference. My name is Dana Safford. So long, and keep on learning.
This has been a PM Lessons Learned podcast. Project Managers, helping project managers by sharing lessons learned. Come join our group. Visit our website at pmlessonslearned.com. Till next time, keep on learning.